Well, this week I got the opportunity to speak to Ms. Polka Mistra, the partner and managing director of Javelin Wealth Management, which is a growing wealth management company that focuses on serving family offices in Singapore. Ms. Mistra grew up in India and started his career in investment banking. When I spoke to her, I can really sense that strong drive she has within herself. And she moved to Singapore in 2010 after the global financial crisis. Over the past decade with the company, she has helped increase the asset under management of the firm by more than 4 times and has been made partner and managing director of the firm. So I sat down with Polka to understand her journey and how she finds that inner drive in her to achieve so many things in her life. It was really a very meaningful chat with her, and I hope you like it as well. Have a listen.
I went through your LinkedIn and I saw mm-hmm. that you are a very serious expert on Taekwondo, right? maybe you can share a little bit on that journey, you know, how your training as a martial artist, when did it start, and how did you gain that interest, and are you still practicing it now?
I am not because of an injury, but I will go back to it. But I'm glad you're talking about it. I'm very passionate about that. It was a very interesting time when I took on Taekwondo. I had to search for Taekwondo classes for adults, right? Because mostly you see children doing it. And when I called them, I was very embarrassed and I said, look, I always wanted to learn martial arts, but I'm so-and-so age. I was 30 plus, right? And they said, no, don't worry. Yeah, people as adults do it, so you can join. So I was very happy about it. And yes, I started. But the reason to start Taekwondo was very interesting. It was a phase in life where things were going fine. Our business was growing. Personally, everything was sorted, but I was just feeling like I was not pushing myself hard enough. And it was just becoming a daily routine life. And I felt something had to give, like it cannot go on like this at this stage of my life. So I kind of needed something to push myself. And I've always wanted to do martial arts. And then I thought, you know, if I do something that pushes me physically a few times a week, then probably that's going to flow into the rest of my life. And it was just completely a random thought and actually worked out exactly like that. I got a couple of double promotions, which I'm very proud of, more than a lot of my grades in school, because at that age, it's not so easy. And yes, I did get my black belt. I got a fracture before I could go for my next level, but I'll get back to it someday.
Ah, I see. Okay, I definitely hope that you can get back to it. And it's definitely quite inspiring, you know, to see that you really started it, not something that your parents push you to it, but rather, you know, something you seek out yourself and finish out at least to the black belt level, which is extremely hard to do, I feel. I have a similar journey as well during COVID, especially because it got too much time on hand, I guess, during COVID. And but I went into motorsports racing as well. Ooh. During that time to learn a little bit more of that. But I can understand you know, your motivation, and but you're definitely much more determined than me to push it all the way to the black belt level.
It becomes self-fulfilling, actually. Once you get to a certain level, then it's very satisfying. And mm-hmm. you know, there were 60-year-olds learning with me, so that was very inspiring. I couldn't give up then.
Wow. thanks for sharing that. So maybe going back to a little bit of your childhood first to understand your upbringing. Maybe you can share a little bit about your childhood. How's your family life growing up, and some of the key family values that I guess your family instill in you?
Yeah, so I grew up in Delhi, and in a big joint family, a typical joint family of India. It was a very closely knit family. And I was the first child in my generation. So as a kid, I had all the attention a kid could ask for. we were not very wealthy. But my grandparents had worked very hard to create a comfortable lifestyle for us. And for my parents and my generation, but nothing was served on a silver platter. It was a middle-class family, you know, you focus on, you know, education, a lot of emphasis on hard work. And the only ask from our family was become independent professionals in your life. You should be standing on your two feet. And the one thing that I can always be thankful for is even back in the day, there was no discrimination between gender in our family. So boys and girls were treated the same. We were all given exactly the same enablement and said, you know, go be yourself, the best version of yourself. We'll enable you to the extent that we can. But yeah, you're not born with a silver spoon in your mouth. So earn your living in the world. So that was childhood. I think I was fortunate to have a family with very strong values. Actually, my grandparents instilled very high moral standards in our family. And that's gone through in the generations. There was no compromise on honesty. There was no compromise on hard work, meritocracy. And, you know, we were basically said, live your life so that you can live it with your head held high. And there were so many instances, you know, and it was through examples. So the way they lived their life and, you know, at a young age, when you see them behaving in a certain manner, it has an it makes an impression on you, and you follow in their footsteps. So could share a few examples if you're interested, but that was the childhood.
Yes. I was actually just about to ask you, can you give a specific example, like some of the more core memories that you might have of that
in your childhood? So quite a lot, and I was thinking about a few. The one of those, and I was very close to my grandparents when I was growing up, along with my parents, of course. And there was a guest who visited us, and was probably around 10 years old or something. They asked my grandfather that, you know, the position that you have in your work, you could make a lot of money with huge bribes that come your way. And it was common. And he said, how do you not give in to temptation? Because he never took a single cent of dishonest money. And his immediate reaction, he didn't even have to think about it, and said that, look, the way I think about it is that if I take any dishonest money, I will end up spending it on my children's medical bills, and that's never worth it. So that's the kind of thought process he had in his mind, that I take bad money, my kids will suffer, it's just not worth it. So, and I was 10 years old, and I still remember it, the way he said it, and I was very proud of him.
I see. Wow. It's interesting that they have this kind of conversation right in front of you as a 10-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
As well.
So, we were pampered as children, but uh-huh. Yes, we had to go live in the big bad world out there. So they prepared us for it.
Right. Okay. And in terms of your education, were there huge pressure from your parents on doing well, or is the pressure internally for yourself that you have to do well in your studies?
It ended up, I think it was more internal. As I said, there was a lot of emphasis on education. So my parents' generation was highly educated. They all did well. Me being the oldest in my generation, it was very, very natural. They didn't have to tell me, but yes, I did work hard on my education. There wasn't the usual kiasu pressure, though. So it was not that, oh, if you don't do this, you're disappointing us. They never said that. What they said is, you know, are you doing your best? So the focus always was on the effort. It was never on the outcome. So that's basically it. But yes, I was self-motivated to. I did enjoy my academics for a very long time.
Nice. When you were choosing, say, on what to do for your university and maybe thinking a little bit about your future career, walk me through that process, I guess, if you still remember. How do you decide? Because what I remember is when I was choosing my university, is more or less a trial and error. I have no idea.
So it was even easier for me back then. you know, your career paths were very templated. So you either became a doctor or you became an engineer. So I was a lot more left-brained, you know, the analytical, logical problem solver. So I chose to become an engineer. So I think kids today have a lot more choices, a lot more vocations to choose from, which is fantastic. But back in the day, no, it was very templated. And basically, then you work towards getting the best college possible. And that's what I did. So very simple. Didn't have to make a choice. it's almost like when I go to a restaurant and as a vegetarian, I have two dishes to choose from.
I understand that. What was university an impactful time for you? Was there anything that stands out for you?
It was absolutely transformative. It was 2,000 students. I went into an engineering college. We were boarding. So 2,000 students. We were all similar age, living on campus together. There were 400 people in our year itself. People from such different backgrounds, you know, different talents, you know, different motivations in life, different journeys in their lives. There was so much to learn from. And it was very interesting. It was very exciting. It was also very humbling because there were so many smart people around us. And it was also very challenging. And I think it'll be hard for you to probably visualize that in Singapore. But back then, very few girls did engineering. So the boys to girls ratio is not men to women anymore, but the boys to girls back then was 20-1.
Oh, wow.
Okay. In a class of 400, we were 20 girls. So that came with its own challenges. Wasn't easy. So yeah, very different environment from what it is now.
Wow. No, I would imagine not just being in a competitive environment, also you have to have a lot of skills in chasing away potential suitors for you as well, given the male to female ratios.
Yeah, it's both a privilege and a curse, isn't it? So. It came with its challenges for sure. But definitely made me stronger, definitely made me even more independent and resilient. I came out a lot stronger and with much stronger belief system in myself.
Right. But interestingly, after you graduate, how did you end up into the financial world?
So I think that's where I made the choice finally of my career, not when I went into college, but... numbers excited me always. I was attracted towards numbers. I was attracted towards analysis, business strategies. Even in my undergrad, I took some courses from the management school because I found it very interesting. So I audited those courses. So finance was just a natural transition. So that's when I started looking for jobs. I looked for banking roles. And I was fortunate enough to get that, and I've not regretted that at all.
But during that time, were you already thinking of maybe someday you will become an entrepreneur, or you have decided that you want to be a full-time professional?
No, there was always a small element of an entrepreneur in me. Where it came from, I don't know, because I come from a family of professionals. I think because of that, it also remains suppressed, because you just don't think you'll run a business because you've never seen anyone run a business. And even though no one discouraged, but no one also even encouraged you to think on those lines. So there was something in me that always told me that, you know what, I want to build something, but I had no clue where to even start back then. I had never seen that. Businessmen were different people.
I understand. So, okay.
Yeah. Right.
And for your first job, you went into more of a research role, I understand. Or how was that like for you? Well, you know, jumping into the financial world.
It was interesting. It was a little different from what I thought I was getting into. So I worked with ANZ Bank initially. So we thought. the roles were going to be more finance focused, but it ended up being a bit more technology. I very soon within ANZ moved into a technology strategy team, which then started aligning more with my analytical brain. And I think I can, it's been many years, I can probably tell you about this now, but I was not completely satisfied with what I was doing then. And this is where I say I'm very lucky with the people I have been surrounded by. I talked to my boss about it, and you know, I said, yeah, this is fun and I love the team, but this is not exactly what I think I want to be doing for my career. It is not core finance. It is more technology strategy. And my boss was sitting, he was standing in the bay and talking, and I was sitting, he was standing, and then he said, yeah, you could do well in a consulting firm. You could do well in banking. Move aside. And okay. And then he just goes on my computer and starts typing something. And he's like, yeah, this one. He said, yeah, I know this company. And yeah, I think you will do well in this company. I can actually put a word in for you. And then he looks over his shoulder. It was a very funny guy. He looks over his shoulder. He's like, you're not going to find a boss often who looks for a job for you, do you? I was like, no, I think I'm the luckiest person on earth. And he actually helped me figure out, you know, what would be the right step, because he knew my strengths and weaknesses. So then I spoke to him and he said, yes, look, absolutely. I got one role and he said, no, this is not for you. I don't like this for you. The second one was investment banking core. And he said, this is what I'm talking about. This is the right one for you. This is what you should go for. So absolute enabler. And I've taken that from him when at Javelin, if someone feels that, okay, they've done their time here and we can't offer them anything more, I've done exactly that for them. You know what? I'd rather you succeed elsewhere than be miserable in my team.
Wow. Wow. That's a wonderful story. I think having such a mentor and also people that can see the potential in us more than ourselves at that time, I think that's very important and definitely lucky as well for you. But I guess that makes you switch your career to investment banking in a sense. And was it as great as you imagined it would be from the start?
Totally. It killed me. Investment banking hours were what they were. Everyone knows about it. And you've got to be a little crazy to enjoy it. But no, I absolutely loved what I did in investment banking.
Wow. And what is it in particular about it that you enjoy?
So one was, of course, the role that I got. I started in a boutique investment bank. So even as an analyst, I was doing all the front-end job that was needed to get a deal to closure. So the exposure was extraordinary, where in a large setup, I would just be sitting there doing financial models for my vice president to take it to the clients. Over there, I had to do everything from start to end, running due diligence, doing share purchase agreements. So the learning was immense. The level of responsibility was immense. So I think I got very lucky with my start there, that it was a boutique and it needed all of us to step up. The team was exceptional. So everyone you spoke to, you learned something, you became a better professional on a daily basis. So the nature of the industry, definitely investment banking is very intellectually challenging. You have to dig deep into business models. You have to work with founders and CEOs on their own strategies, and that you can't learn more about business than from people who successfully built them, right? So to me, all that just it was a vicious circle. I learned more than I wanted to learn more. I wanted to do more deals. I wanted to work with more of such people, understand more about how more industries are run. So not a single regret about it. Loved it, absolutely. Killed me, but I loved it.
That's amazing. And but also during that time, I saw that during that time is also right in the midst of the global financial crisis as well. And in investment banking during that time, must be, although it's a challenging time, but I assume that it's a very highly stressed environment as well. Talk me through during that crisis period, you know, what went through your mind and what was happening?
I think in the beginning, mine just shut down, didn't it? So we had no idea what was happening in the market. Most of us had never witnessed anything like that before in finance industry, especially the ones who had entered recently. Everything was hunky-dory. Nothing could go wrong. And suddenly, everything was going wrong. As a business, the firm was doing fine, but we saw deals completely dry out. Deals you had worked on for a whole year, put on hold indefinitely. In our case, the firm was very, very honorable. What they said is, look, we appreciate every one of you in the team and you're doing a great job. We're not going to do retrenchments. But you got to know that, yes, you're not going to expect big bonuses or hikes or anything of that sort. And I think everyone aligned to that. No one complained about it. But seeing our peers lose their jobs, seeing people's wealth being wiped out completely, people's pensions were wiped out. It was very shocking. And, you know, early stages of your career, you're thinking, have I made the biggest mistake of my life already? So, yeah, very hard.
What do you think is the biggest lesson that you learned during that period?
The question is, did the right people learn the lessons or not? And it seems maybe they did not. But yes, it was a massive dose of overconfidence to start with, thinking nothing can go wrong. I think a lot of lessons to learn, especially, look, M&A deals fell through. They happened later. That was fine. But on the wealth management side of industry, it was, you're wiping out people's entire wealth. All their hard work has gone down the drain. There are people who have retired and then they lost all their pension money. So I think there were bigger lessons to learn over there. You've got to respect people's money. You cannot trade it with that cowboy attitude. It was heartbreaking to see. But yeah, whether institutions have learned their lessons or not, I think the industry overall did. There are more regulations in place. There are less chances of something of that magnitude happening because there are checks and balances. Now when we onboard clients, when we put clients into different products, there's a lot more diligence that is done. But, you know, there are bad actors everywhere, and it's at the end of the day, it's the people, not just the regulations. So we need constant reminders as an industry, I think.
Mm-hmm. It seems that it has a very big impact on actually how you manage your client and manage wealth right now at Javelin, in putting in, you know, the control and being more conservative in handling your clients.
Yeah. Actually, I wasn't with Javelin then, but yeah, I would like to share what Javelin did back then because it had a big influence in me joining Javelin later.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But in 2008, Javelin actually returned clients' money and saying that this is not the time for us to guess what's going to happen in the market, which is so unpredictable. And you're better off holding cash, and we cannot justify charging you a fee for it. So we feel that when the time is right, we'll let you know. And if you still wish to come back to us, you can. But at this time, your money is better with you under your care. And guess what? Each and every client came back.
Wow.
So this, of course, I found out later, and that played a big role in joining Javelin.
That's the amount of, I guess, the fiduciary duty that the founder has for the clients is impeccable on that sense. But going back on your personal journey as well, I guess after that crisis, you have decided that you want to come to Singapore. Is that right? Or how did that decision came about?
Yeah, so I visited Singapore in 2008, fell in love with the place, what's not to like. Mm-hmm. And I decided, yes, I did want to build a career over here. And 2010, I was here.
Mm.
So it was just, I thought it was just love at first sight back then.
That's nice. And I guess after that, you were still in the you still joined investment banking firm as well.
Yeah.
Is it still doing similar type of work?
Yes.
As well, no.
Yes, it was. I joined Daiwa Capital Markets, where I was again doing investment banking, mergers and acquisitions, much larger setup, very nice team, very nice people, and I enjoyed my work there too. It was not the easiest job market, so it was challenging to find a job. It took me several months to get a role that I really wanted to do. So again, there was a time when I was thinking, have I made the right decision, or should I just have stayed with a comfy job back home? But it worked out, and I'm glad it did. So it was very similar. I enjoyed investment banking, and I was lucky to get that. It was definitely not an easy market in 2010.
Yes, that's true. But, you know, migrating is always a big decision in life. Is it something that you have always think about since young of moving away from India, or is, you know, something that just crossed your mind when you started to visit Singapore more and more?
So migrating was, I don't know whether it's migrating, whether it's just a movement. It wasn't as hard for me as it was for a lot of other people. It is for many individuals. Also, it's because when I was younger, my dad had a transferable job. So we moved cities quite often. So, you know, 3 years in one city. We've lived in Bombay, Mumbai now, Goa, Mauritius, Ranchi, various cities in India, Mauritius. So every 3-4 years, we were used to moving. So actually, that kind of became, the first move was hard, you know, leaving all your friends, you're younger, crying my eyes out and saying, whoa, what's happened to my life? But once it happened, it was great to make friends in a new place and, you know, get to know new cultures. So I kind of started enjoying that change, you know, and you really experience a city more when you live there rather than when you visit as a tourist. So the move to Singapore was not very pre-planned, but when I saw and when I decided that, you know, I want to do that, it didn't feel like a very big decision. So it was because I was used to change. And even when I was working, I worked in Bangalore and Bombay, so then Bengaluru and Mumbai now. So it was natural to me. It wasn't that difficult.
I see. Okay.
And Singapore is not too far from home as well.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense. It's something that you have experienced since young, and you're moving to different cities for work seems like a natural transition as well.
Actually, now Singapore is probably the place I have stayed the longest.
Would you... If your career, you know, Javelin need to set up another office somewhere else, would you still be open to moving again?
Yeah, I'm much older now. I'll probably think a lot more. More baggage to carry with. The Singapore's been home for us for a very long time. Yes, if we see opportunity, if there's an opportunity to grow Javelin, if that's the need, I'll absolutely do it. I'm very passionate about our business. And yes, that's priority in life for sure.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess maybe I wanted to understand also, again, the transition of investment banking, and how do you move into private wealth, and how do you chance upon Javelin? And of course, the founder, Mr. Davis, as well. Maybe you can tell us that story.
It was really, like you said, chanced upon. So, like I told you earlier, there was always an entrepreneurial bug in me, but I just didn't know how to satisfy that itch. I happened to meet Steve absolutely by chance through a common connect. And I 100% resonated with Javelin's value proposition. So what Steve was doing was he was tackling the industry's conflict of interest and building a business the right way. And that's something I had wanted to do. So when we spoke and when I saw what he was trying to do and what he had been doing, it just clicked. And we connected and we said, you know what, why don't we build this together? And it's been fantastic ever since. His thinking behind that was the industry is very commission focused, and prioritization of client services was quite lacking. And when he set it up, he couldn't find this kind of advice for himself. So he said, okay, you know what? I'm going to set it up and do it the right way. So it was not a planned move. We met and sometimes it just clicked. And that's exactly what happened. And 10 years since, we're still working together, building the business.
Yes, that's amazing. But was the transition from investment banking to wealth management easy transition for you? Or?
No. No.
What was the biggest challenges for you?
Oh, how many hours you have?
We can have a few parts on this interview, no worries.
No, it was not easy, as much as I would like to pretend. It was a completely new industry for me. I dealt with institutions. This is very personal, right? This institutions required a different personality and different way of thinking to deal with, right? But on the private wealth side, you're dealing with an individual, a person, you're dealing with their life, you're supporting them with everything related to their life and their wealth. You have to have empathy. You have to be able to put yourself in your client's shoes. And that was huge learning for me. And it took me a long time. It wasn't easy because on investment banking side, you're just completely left brain, right? Logic. This makes sense. This is what you have to do. That's it. Let's move on from it, right?
Yep.
But here you have to dig deep. You have to give comfort to the clients and you have to build that trust. And building trust takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort. And it does not, you can't fake it. You just cannot fake it. So until you build that empathy for the clients are not going to trust you. They're extremely smart. They're extremely perceptive. So it was a huge learning for me. It not just on the business side, but just on a personal side as well.
Right. So I assume now you have trained your right brain to be much more stronger than your left brain.
Yes, I woke it up.
Yes. One of the key things I think that attracted me about you and also about Javelin is also when Kewei introduced you to me. I looked through Javelin and what you guys are doing. It also resonates a lot with me, which because I also feel that the industry is has always been too commission based and too commission focused. Which is so what you're trying to do is something quite personal to me as well, which is also something that I'm trying to do on a much smaller scale on a personal level for my clients. And so, can you also explain a little bit, you know, when we talk about private wealth, family office, to the mass market, we might not be very familiar with this term. And we might heard of it, but we have no idea what exactly does a family office do. So in a sense, can you compare it to, say, maybe on a premium banking and private wealth and family office? What's the key difference there?
So I think the commonality is simple. We are all looking for a trusted advisor, right? It's a service-driven industry. It's about trust. But on the private wealth side, increasingly now, clients are looking for more holistic advice, not just portfolio management, right? So to give you a few examples. Now, we have clients which are large family offices. Then we have wealthy individuals as our clients. And then we also have individuals who are kind of starting on their wealth journey. And all three of the categories have different specific needs and requirements. You talk about a family office or large single family, they want an advisor who understands the complexities and dynamics of the family in the first place, because only then you can help build and execute a wealth plan for them, which supports the entire family. You have to help manage those relationships. You have to help manage the idiosyncrasies as well. and then helping these families formalize that family office structure. That's a big need, and it's a very growing segment in Singapore, the single family office structures and the multi-family office structures. So you almost become a part of the family. You understand their every need, you know, their quirks, and you have to work with them. They're individuals. You have to remember that. But when you come to, say, our high net worth individual clients, what they want is they basically want an end-to-end offering. Mm. What that means is, you know, from you do their goal settings for them, you plan their investment for them, you manage their investment for them, but at the same time, you help them do, say, succession planning, setting up of wills, setting up of trust structure, help them plan for their retirement, ensure that, you know, we're putting enough money aside for their kids' education, help them plan for their taxes, you know, what properties they're going to purchase in their retirement. So all that entire wealth journey, they want their advisor to cover for them. And these are very busy individuals, right? They don't have the time. They cannot have the expertise on all these fronts. So that's what they want us for. It's almost like a concierge service for everything related to wealth management. Mm. And then we have the clients who are starting on the wealth journey. You know, say, for example, a 30, 40-year-old professional starting off accumulation of wealth, their compensation is fair enough. They will have steady cash flows for several years going forward. Now, what they are looking for is not just a portfolio manager anymore, but also a coach to teach them how to even think about a wealth plan, to think about how to manage their portfolio, to help them figure out their actual risk appetite as opposed to what they think it is. Mm-hmm. So that's more hand-holding over there. So these are the expectations that different categories of clients have on the wealth space. Not sure if I answered your question correctly.
Yep, it definitely give a much more detailed understanding of how private wealth works. But something struck me, which when you're talking about helping manage for families and setting up family office and being the concierge service for them, does that also entails, you know, within the family, there's always family conflict. Would you be there to mitigate that as well?
Absolutely, you have to be there. And I mean, families actually sometimes have written family charters. We have to help them build that as well. So definitely you are really part of the family. And you know, it is easier because within themselves they'll have their interpersonal issues, but then there's this independent party who's focusing on everyone's benefit. So it becomes a lot easier conversation for them to have with us as opposed to one-on-one. And every family, every individual is different. Our roles are different in every mandate.
Right. And when it comes to giving advice to them, can you, I wouldn't ask you for a specific example, but what happens when, say, a client's make a decision that is totally contrary to your advice? How do you typically manage that?
It happens. It happens not very often. Your job is to make the client aware of their own decisions as an advisor. You have to bring every perspective to the table. So if we think, let's take a very simple example. A client wants to buy a particular stock and we don't think they should buy that stock, then we would explain to the client as much to the extent possible, you know, these are the reasons why this is not relevant for you, whether it is the technicals, whether it is the risk profile, whether it is tax implications, and we give them the whole knowledge. But at the end of the day, it is the client's decision. So, but I don't think we've been in those situations. And at the end, sometimes the client would say, look, I get you, I understand it. If this goes wrong, this is on me. I really want to do it. It's like, sure. And then if it goes wrong, they call us to say, please don't say I told you so.
That's great if they take it all in good faith.
Yes.
One of the bigger, I guess, event that happens over the last few years was also, of course, COVID. And during that time, I am assuming that, you know, you have to make quite a big changes to your business, as well as managing clients' expectation, especially during the first few months where it's extremely volatile.
Yes.
Can you walk us through, you know, once that lockdown was announced, how do you manage through that crisis?
So the logistics of it was not difficult at all, in the sense that as part of our disaster planning and business continuity planning, we had set ourselves infrastructurally to be able to work remotely. So from that perspective, it was a rather seamless transition for our business, at least. We could work from home. We just increased communication. What was the interpersonal interactions, those we had to manage. However, what happened in the markets during COVID in those first few weeks and months was one of the hardest times for us as a business. And all our energy during that time was spent convincing clients not to sell at the bottom. So when things go so bad and they're so unpredictable, it's very natural to panic. And that's what our role is, to take the emotions out of it and be the logic. What we tend to do generally as advisors, we send a note to clients every month. But when the markets are bad, when the situation is difficult, we increase our communication to the clients. So when we were getting all those circuit breakers in the markets, we started sending notes out to clients almost every second day. We offered to get on calls, said, we know it is unprecedented, but at the same time, please remember that your portfolio is structured to be able to take XYZ amount of drawdown. We showed them their investment policy, saying, this is what we agreed, this is why we structured it. It's very important to explain the reason. So we explained it to them, and we managed to keep them put with their portfolios. And the best call we could have made, because very soon the portfolios recovered, and several clients then called us to thank us after that, saying, thanks for, you know, keeping me from making that mistake. And it's normal, you know, the clients, you treat your own portfolio very differently from what you would do for your clients, right? You're more emotional about your portfolio. So it was not an easy time. It's never easy to see clients' hard-earned money dropping, but we had to work through it. And that's why we have our processes. That's why we have our documentation. And that's why we ensure that our communication with the clients is up to date, and we always are aligned with them. So that helped a lot. And during COVID, we did not lose a single client, and we came out stronger after COVID. We got a lot more referrals from our clients because of the work that we did back then.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Definitely, I personally remembered that period, you know, because just by managing my own portfolio, even though I'm a long-term investor and have been investing for 16, 17 years, sudden drop in asset prices during that period is also quite a stressful time, you know, just on a personal level, I'm sure. With that, you shared this example of, you know, trying to convince the client that don't sell during the bottom, and don't panic when things are not doing well. But on the flip side, you can also share what happens when you realize that one of the advice that you give your client turned out to be actually wrong. And how do you manage that? How do you remedy that? Because I know that, you know, from my own investment, it's almost impossible that I'm always 100% right.
Yeah.
Right?
No. It's exactly that. The first thing you do is you just own up to it. Simple. A simple note. Yes, we got this wrong. And we got this wrong for this reason. We thought this would happen, but this happened. That's it. And simple, honest, transparent explanation to the clients, and clients understand it. Like I said, clients are extremely smart, and clients are forgiving. They're not expecting you to be perfect. They do understand that we can't get it all right. if we could get all the calls right in the market, we're not human, right? We've obviously developed a time machine. What's important, and in our case especially, because when we recommend products to clients, we have no conflict over there. We don't get paid to recommend any product. We're always selecting independent products. So they know that there's no reason for us to recommend anything to them other than the fact that we think it is best for them. Mm. So again, it boils down to communication. At the time when you purchase something for the client or you decide some strategy for the client, it needs to be properly documented and explained to the client to get the buy-in. And if you get it wrong, take it on the chin, accept it. You got it wrong, whether it was a mistake or whether it was a wrong call, it happens, and move on from that mistake. You never ride your losses. If you've got it wrong, close it and move on from it. Don't get into a recovery mode. So that's our approach all the time. It's always straight up.
Mm. One thing that I find really interests me is that in the last decade, at least, we have always been in a very low interest rate environment. and the market, you know, from the huge QE program to the low interest rate, it seems on hindsight now, right, that stock market will tend to do well. But now we're moving into another era with, moderate interest rate. And seems like a different set of rules might apply in the future. So with this huge shift in the interest rate environment, how would you see your advice changing during this period?
Oh, yeah. This is a complete regime change for sure. From lower for longer, we are going for higher for longer, right? You look at what happened in the U.S. markets, not U.S. markets, but yes, the U.S. numbers yesterday, sluggish growth, high inflation, that just reflects the point that we're still not into the rate cut environment yet. And even if they're going to be rate cuts, they're not going to be as fast as the markets expect them to be. Data point, I think at the start of the year, the market was expecting 7 rate cuts. And now they're expecting 1.
Yes.
So it's not going to happen that soon. And we've maintained that it would not happen that soon. The bigger risk is a major reassessment of what the value of different asset classes should be, right? So say, for example, now high interest rates are probably going to be a new normal around 3.5-4%. Then highly levered companies, they're going to be less favored. So you have to rebalance your portfolios accordingly. Equity investors will demand for higher yield, which is probably going to cause prices to fall. Not a bad thing because the PE comes down to a 14 to 16 range as opposed to the 18 to 20, which doesn't look sustainable. Bond yields, definitely in the past days, we had something around 2.5 to 3.5% range. We think they will persist at 4 to 4.5%. And we're talking about long-term bond yields here. So definitely a restructuring of the portfolio. Cash is generating returns. So that's become, again, an investment product. And what we've also observed is that leverage in wealth management has dropped significantly because it's expensive now. So it's borrowing is going to be lower for fixed income and equity products. So you have to restructure your portfolios accordingly. If you haven't already done that, I think where the market got it wrong was in the expectations of the rate cuts and the pace of the rate cut, which now has come to 4. We are in April and we are not anywhere close to even the first one.
Yeah.
It's a lot more technical explanation. That's just part of the job, sorry.
That's great. We always try to have more insights, you know, from industry experts like yourself to analyze the market, the ever-changing market for us. Now maybe going back a little bit on your personal level, and mm-hmm. I can definitely sense this huge drive within yourself, and the success that you have created for yourself in your career. And I found this in many of the people that I speak with as well, which is very hard for successful people like you to surrender per se, or when you hit a challenge, you know, it's never in your mind that I should give up, I should find something easier to do. But rather, sometimes the higher the challenges, the more motivated that you become. Is that kind of attitude, do you think that is something that is innate in you, or you feel that it can be cultivated in anyone?
That's a very difficult question. It's a very difficult question. And I don't know how much of that is innate. I agree, you have to have that attitude. You just, one thing that I resonate with, a slight digression, but the way you posed the question, it reminded me of Tom Cruise in The Last Samurai. You know, he keeps getting hit and he keeps getting up till he's completely done, and somehow that resonates. Mm-hmm. That you just don't give up. I think after some time it does become second nature when you've been doing what you're doing. Running a business is not easy. However, you do come close to giving up sometimes. It's especially early stages of the business. It's not all rosy. And yes, you're right. Somehow you find that extra bit of energy to get out of that slump and come back. Where did that come from? I haven't been able to figure that out. It's difficult. I think the person who said it the best was, or explained the concept the best, was Steve Jobs, when he said that, you know, dots connect when you look backwards. They don't connect looking forward. So you kind of have to trust that the dots will connect somehow down the line. And I think the one thing that helps is to remind yourself of the why. Now, why are you doing this? And that gives you that extra motivation that you need when things are all down. So why are you running your business? Why are you doing this interview? So if things go bad, and you know, why are you getting up and going to work? Just reminding that to yourself helps. But other than that, yes, it's not a question I can give you a good answer to. I really don't know. It's necessary, I think. And yes, I do that. I think most of the entrepreneurs, they have that attitude in them. Cultivating it, I'm sure you can cultivate it, but you need that motivation. If there's something that you really believe in, I think you'll do it. You'll just absolutely do it. You just need to see the possibility.
Yep, I think that the one thing that you touched on while explaining that is finding the why on why exactly you're doing it. And it's also kind of to a larger extent, the reason or the pursuit that you feel is worthwhile to spend your time on and create your version of success. And nowadays, you know, I guess from, say, our parents' generation, there's typically only one type of success, right? Just get rich. But as we evolve now, with our life a little bit less living on the edge, there's many versions of success coming out right now. And I would really like to know your personal level of your personal explanation or definition of success at this moment of time. How do you define it, and where are you journeying to at this moment?
I'm glad you said at this moment, because that's very relevant. It changes with your age and stage of life. Younger version of me would have exactly said that, money, right? So, and a much younger version of me would have said, oh yeah, I need to do it well in my exams, and that was success. So at this point, I think a few things make me feel successful. First, definitely building a credible business while doing the right thing, both for the clients and the team. So the business should be driven towards supporting its clients as well as the employees, because without them, you have no business. So that definitely, to me, I feel that is for me what I feel more successful about, not the paycheck that the business gives me. I also feel very successful when I'm able to enable my team to realize their potential and succeed in life. And I gave you the example of my ex-boss who did that for me. And I think that just came through for me. So when I have a young team member and I see potential in them, I drive them, I push them, saying, look, you're better than this. You can achieve this. This is what you can do in life. And when they achieve that, it gives me a lot of personal satisfaction. I feel very successful when I get people to realize that they can do more than what they actually thought that they could. And it's the same thing helping clients achieve their goals, helping individuals achieve new milestones in life. Somehow it just gives me a feeling of success. One example is scuba diving. So I do scuba diving and I love the underwater world. But then I decided to become an instructor. And I realized that I feel more happy and satisfied when I get a new student who is a bit scared of water to get over that fear, become a diver, and experience that first dive. So that's, I feel more successful about that and then maybe a strong student, actually. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are a few things at this stage, at least, which make me feel either successful or satisfied.
I can definitely resonate with that. You know, it's not, I guess your version of success is no longer on individual achievement, but mm-hmm. rather the impact that you can give and the help that you can give others, and seeing them improve would bring, pleasure to yourself and also happiness to yourself. And that's actually one of the key reasons why I have been doing all these interviews and also uploading some of the things that I upload to my YouTube channel. And it reminds me of actually one of the key YouTube videos that I saw very early on when YouTube kind of first started was by a professor called Randy Pausch, and mm-hmm. I think the video was The Meaning of Life or something along that title. And he was actually giving his last lecture in the university because he was diagnosed with cancer. And he gave his last lecture videoed and uploaded on YouTube. And at the end of it, he explained why he's doing it. And it basically said that this video was created not just for the public, but rather something that he wanted to pass on to his children, and he would be there to teach them. And that really resonated to me, and it kind of want me to create all this depository of information and wealth of knowledge that I learned from people like you and successful people who has reached not just in terms of wealth, but in terms of their life fulfillment and contentment as well. I just wanted to collect all this information, and because with kids, sometimes when you talk to them one-on-one, they're not going to understand, they're not going to care what you said. So having it uploaded I guess at their own time, and when they feel that it's more meaningful to them, I hope that it's something that they can learn from, and I still have this information that I've learned from people like yourself. So
That's an incredible way to think about it. Yeah.
And so impressive. Thank you so much for your time. But before you go, I guess I always ask one last question to everyone, which is if you look back, on your journey, and if you were to being able to meet your younger self again, to go through this journey again, what is one key advice that you give yourself before you take on this life journey?
Be more humble than you were at the start. I think, as I said in the beginning, it was a huge learning experience for me when I moved to the wealth management space. I completely underestimated the importance of, I think, coming from institutional background, how do I explain it? So I thought it was straightforward. I just underestimated the complexity, and I just underestimated how much effort it actually takes, because it came from an outside perspective. Okay, it shouldn't be hard. This is all logical. So it was when I started getting more involved and when I started attending more and more client meetings is when I realized that it needs all of you. You cannot take it lightly. And I completely underestimated the personal pressure that you feel when you are responsible for someone's entire wealth and that they're trusting you with their hard-earned money. That came to me a bit later, and it hit me like a truck. So yeah, so that's why I say be more humble at the start, because then that lesson would have come easier and sooner. I wasn't humble enough on that front, for sure.
Thank you for sharing that. It's a fascinating talk with you, and I really enjoy it. And so everyone, just we have been speaking with partner and managing director of Javelin Wealth, Ms. Poka Mishra, and really glad to have you on. I hope I can speak to you in the future as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure talking to you, Stanley. It was really fun.
Thank you for your time. And my name is Stanley. You have been listening to The Asian Mavericks. You can listen to our other episode on my YouTube channel, Learn with Stanley. If you like this show, I hope you give us a rating and a review as well. You can find all our official social media channel from our website, learnwithstanley.com. So feel free to reach out and let me know how I can improve the show for you. Thank you, and till we meet again, stay safe.